carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know the chain gotta go. It's been so long, a little too long, but the chain just gotta go.
Well, he does inspire that in people.
He really does. Yeah. It's like, you're happy for them, and then you're like, don't cry.
Yeah, it's like, okay. It is comics, now. There's no crying in comics.
There's just crying in comics. I like that.
Hi, this is Greg, and I'm here at SPX 2013 with one of the co-authors of the book March from Top Shelf Comics. This is Andrew Iden. Andrew, how's it going?
It's going great, man. Thanks for having me.
Not a problem. So I had a copy of the book signed by all three of you, since you were all three here yesterday, and I had a chance to read it last night, and it is amazing. It is a wonderful, wonderful book.
Thank you.
I think it would be fair to say that of the three people listed on the cover, you're probably the person people know the least about. So why don't you take a second and tell us sort of how you became involved in this project?
Well, I was working as Congressman Lewis's press secretary in 2008 on his campaign.
Okay.
And, you know, we were coming to the end of the campaign talking about what we were going to do after.
Mm-hmm.
And I just freely admitted I was going to a comic book convention, right? And everybody in politics sort of looks at you like you have a third eye or something when you say that, but they were sort of laughing, and the congressman said, you know, don't laugh. There was a comic book during the civil rights movement, and it was incredibly influential.
Mm.
And so, you know, that was sort of one of those moments. And I went on to learn about the comic, and it actually helped inspire some of the earliest sit-ins and inspire the Greensboro Four, and it had an impact. And then it ended up having a history that played itself out all across the world. And, you know, learning that, I'm like, okay, this is a 14, 16-page comic book.
Mm-hmm.
What if you told and it's just about the Montgomery bus boycotts.
Mm-hmm.
So what if you told the rest of the civil rights movement? And knowing what I know about Congressman Lewis, I knew what an unbelievable story he had of his own involvement. I mean, he was a part of so many major moments.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just seemed almost self-evident to me, why wouldn't he write a comic book? So I started asking that, right? Which, you know, when you ask a sitting member of Congress, why don't you write a comic book, he kind of says, you're a little crazy, son, you know.
However,
you know, the more I thought about it, it was like it made sense. It just made sense. And so I kept asking, and I kept asking, and finally he said, you know what, okay, I'll do it, but only if you write it with me. So that was sort of the throwing down of the gauntlet, and that was 5 years ago, and now here we are.
So when he says, why don't you write it with me, like, how does that actually work? Like, I mean, I'm a bit of a process junkie, so...
Yeah.
I'm like, does he sort of, like, tell it to you, and then you sort of... Actually, why don't you...
Okay, well, no, what happened was is, you know, first I had to put together a proposal.
Okay.
And...
For him
the
or
book.
For Top Shelf?
No, for whatever publisher we went to.
Okay.
And so, you know, I actually pitched it. The first person to ever help me with this was actually Karen Berger from Vertigo. And, you know, she's just a wonderful, wonderful woman. She was incredibly helpful in getting me to focus and figure out what it was, and... Ultimately, it didn't work out with DC, but...
Ironic.
Yeah. Well, you know, everybody's got their things they got to do. And so she was very, very helpful, though, and she really helped me put together a good book proposal and to sort of figure out how I could do this. And what ended up happening was I would interview the congressman. I would look through the historic data and the research of the books and everything, because there's so much written about this topic. But I would really think about it in terms of the congressman's story, like his role, right? Because what was so interesting to me about his story in general is that he was so young. And we see young people today who are like, I can't do anything. My vote doesn't matter. I can't change the world. What are you talking about?
This is not that case.
He was 18, 19 years old, sitting in. He got arrested for the first time on February 27, 1960, a week after his 20th birthday, right? 3 years later, at 23 years old, he's the youngest speaker at the March on Washington. Right? 23 years old, right? And so, seeing that context, it's like, imagine if we could get the 23-year-olds today to think of themselves in a light where they really could do something.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the difference, right? It was nonviolence. Because it is a simple set of core principles and tactics that allow you to take a situation and dramatize it in such a way that helps you advance your cause, that helps you get to where you want to go and to change what you want to change. And these lessons, there's the core principles, and then you apply those in different ways across different issues. And so what we hope to show in March is the different ways that was used. It was used differently in Nashville than it was in Birmingham or Montgomery. It was used differently there than it was in Albany. It was used differently than it was... And each place had its own specific set of challenges. Mm-hmm. And so as we did this and we did the research, it was telling it from Congressman Lewis's perspective, mm-hmm. as a young person, you know, becoming chairman of SNCC, and giving that entry point. And so... You know, you just lay out the story, you interview the congressman, you get his word, because it is an oral history, mm-hmm. And then you structure it the best you can. I'm a comics fan, so I knew what I wanted it to look like, mm-hmm. And so then you sort of work to that point, and we worked up a script, then we turned that over to Chris Staros, who read through it, helped with some edits, then we turned that over to Nate, and Nate was like, you know, this is not one book. This is a little bit bigger than one book, right? And 'cause I, you know... Nate has such a beautiful style that breaks down the rules of comics in some ways, where, mm-hmm. where he can get out of that framework that leaves a page as something more than just panels, you know? And so it was, once he got a hold of the script, he laid it out as pencils and then put his own twist on, you know, we're constantly working together on what to keep, what not to keep, like how to do it right and how to make it just the so. Mm-hmm. And it was really a wonderful collaboration between the three of us. To put this together.
Good. One of the things I don't know if I'd say I liked it, because it was really sort of a tough part to get through of the book, was that in using nonviolence, there's a lot of like inherent not there's a lot of inherent violence in using nonviolence. I mean, not from the sort of the user's perspective, but one of the scenes that really grabbed me was when they were sort of preparing in sort of the training, unquote, where they would have, you know, like half of the students be like the, you know, the protesters, the other half being like the sort of the antagonists, and what they had to go through, and then they would switch roles. And there's one guy in the book, and he's like, I can't do this, like I can't. And that really brought home the fact that, like, you know, you're not using violence, but there's still like, it's, let's see if I can say this right, like it's peaceful sort of as a concept, but the actual reality of it, which you guys show really well in the book, is that there's a lot of, it's not easy to be nonviolent, and the people that can be nonviolent, it really shows how much strength of character that they have to be able to put up with and sort of maintain the sort of core of, you know, not only like I'm not going to strike back, but to one of the things that they mentioned in the book is that, you know, you teach them to sort of love your attacker, and to be able to do that. I don't know if I would have the strength to be able to do that. So I think one of the things that is really good in the book that you guys get across, the strength of character that it takes for somebody, be it Congressman Lewis or whoever sort of in that movement, to be able to do that, to have that sort of strength of character.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, you are absolutely right. It's something that... It's something that when we think about these folks... We have to think about the courage, mm-hmm. and the discipline. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes today you see protesters who do not approach it with a disciplined attitude.
Right.
They are seeking some sort of rebellion.
Yeah.
But if you're going to make it work, this is a tactical, disciplined decision.
Yeah.
And you have to approach it as if the same precision you would with a military campaign or something else, right?
Right.
Because it's not easy. If it was easy, everybody'd do it.
Right. It's like, I mean... You mentioned military campaign or like a martial art, like judo, is like using somebody else's energy sort of against them, like using that. And it's almost, that was the other thing that was sort of going through my head, is you show a couple of times during the book, during that, and then even the opening, which is completely, I'm assuming we're getting back to that scene that you sort of opened with, because like there is some, I know it's the beginning of the book, I don't really want to spoil it, but you know, 3 or 4 pages into the book, you're like, oh, this is some serious stuff is going to go down here. And the book does a good job of sort of balancing between going in and having, like a oral, like you said, an oral history, a sort of Congressman Lewis sort of reciting sort of what's happening, what's happened to him in his life, and having Nate sort of, you know, illustrate that, and you're seeing it, you know, as somebody sort of telling it to you. And then the first couple of pages, you get more of a, you are there sort of impact. You're like, you know, I mean, if you hear about the book, you're like, oh, it's, you know, this guy telling you about his life, and then the first couple pages, you are in his life, and man, it is messed up. There is some stuff. But I really, it's tough, I think, I mean, maybe it's not tough for some people, but certainly there are parts of the book where it was almost like being now that we're sort of on the other side, hopefully on the other side of history, you look back at some of these things that they were going up against, and you're like, that's stupid. Why can't, you know, why were things like that? And I think the book does a good job of explaining to people who, you know, may not have been alive during that, weren't alive during that time, or weren't alive, you know, even decades sort of after that, to be able to say, look, this happened, you know, less than 50 years ago. We were in a completely different sort of social place, and this is what people, you know, this is what was going on. People felt like they had to change that. These are the ways that they, you know, that they took to change that. And like you said, they can maybe apply that to something that, you know, that you feel, you know, today is something that maybe you want to exact some change, and maybe, you know, these are some things that you can use. So the first book is out. When is the second book?
We're hopefully optimistic that it will be released in November 2014.
Okay. And any plans on the third book?
We're looking at probably a San Diego debut 2016. Each book gets successively longer. Next book will be about 200, 180 pages, 200 pages. And the third book will be over 200. Okay. Because, you know, when we wrote it, it was a single volume, and it was written as a three-act play, basically. Mm-hmm. And each act contained two major story arcs. Mm-hmm. So the next one, it'll really focus on the Freedom Rides and the March on Washington and Birmingham and that whole 1963 campaign. And so when you get into that, you know, that's a long story, and it's hard not to... what do you leave out?
Right.
You know, and so especially as we get into some of these things where there's so many important players, you can't cut anybody out. Actually, one of the fun things I do with the books is I've been trying to get all the folks who are still alive who are in the book to sign it. I got Fred Gray to sign a copy of March to me the other day, right? The attorney in the book. Mm-hmm. He's still around. He lives in Tuskegee. And he came by the office and I got him to sign it. It was really cool. So as we, you know, the thing about these books is it's going to end up being cameos galore. I mean, you know, and when we deal with Inauguration Day, just wait until you see Aretha Franklin's hat. You know, I mean, it's just different things like that where it's like, it's so much fun to go through this story and put context around it after having, like, lived through the Inauguration Day portion with the congressman and hearing him tell these stories, you know, bringing that experience alive for everybody. It shouldn't have been just me that experienced it. It just ended up being that way because... somebody had to hold his coat, you know?
Right.
So bringing that alive and showing everybody how special and meaningful this was, and then at the same time reinforcing the fact that if you believe in something and you're willing to fight for it, you may not reach that goal today, tomorrow, even next week, next month, or next year, but if you fight for it and you really believe in it, maybe 40 or 50 years later, you might be successful. Right. Because if you want to change our society, it is possible, but it's not easy.
No. Let's talk a little bit about the reception. So the book's been out about, what, a month now?
Ish, yeah, about a month.
And you had some sort of, like, debut or whatever at San Diego.
Yeah, right? That was a soft launch. It was just, I mean, come on, man. I'm a comics fan. Like, isn't it everybody's fantasy to debut their first book at San Diego?
Yeah. And you did that. What was that like?
I mean, it was unreal. I mean, we had 100 people camp out outside of the panel. We had the line at the booth was so long the fire marshal threatened to shut us down. So we had to like rearrange everything and be like, no, we're good. We're going to fix this, you know, because there's so many people, right? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of amazing to me because I think it shows how hungry people are for a story like this. That, you know, of course superheroes are going to always do well. But there is a audience in comics that is ready for serious nonfiction comics that deal with history, that deal with important topics that are relevant today. Yeah. And they deal with it in a new narrative that maybe necessarily don't fit into the, sort of our traditional mold. I mean, Nate is such an untraditional artist in many respects because, I mean, he really doesn't follow the rules of the page. He's invented his own game. And it's part of what makes March so special, you know, is the way he shows this, that gives it so much depth, so much appeal, that I could never convey as a writer, or the congressman could never convey through his words. And so, you know, it's just, there is something happening, and I think it's just the beginning, you know. I mean, when they talk about, like, these big books, and the Mouse, and the Persepolis, and things like that, I think it's time for us to start noticing that comic books are becoming literature. They are becoming their own canon. And the game has been changed. And I'm just really happy to be a part of it.
Has there been any talk about getting this into, making any sort of like concerted effort to get this into schools, into, classroom, sort of high school? You know, college, but also maybe like lower, you know, high school, middle school, that sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is this a little early to sort of?
No, we actually have a teacher's guide that's free to download.
Okay.
From the Top Shelf website. Just go to topshelfcomics.com/March. Okay. It was prepared by Peter Gutierrez from the National Council of Social Studies and School Library Journal.
Okay.
So it's pretty serious. It's a wonderful addition if you're going to use this in the classroom.
Okay.
One of the things we were really excited about is within 2 weeks of the book's debut, it ended up on Georgia Tech's English 101 syllabus. You know, and so I think.
Does that blow your mind a little?
A little bit, yeah. I mean, I'm from Atlanta. My grandfather went to Georgia Tech. I was telling the family, and they're all like, you know, kind of like taken aback that now, like, some of these kids are going to be reading this book now every year when they come into college. But, you know, I think there's room also in middle and high schools, too, and particularly as we complete the trilogy, to look at this because. You know, the way they teach this in class sometimes is stagnant in some ways, you know, and this may help
for a bunch of reasons. I mean, I think maybe because of the amount of time they literally can devote to that, and this and that. That's one of the things I really liked about the about historical comics in general and this book specifically is it's very easy to get across a sense of place, a sense of time that will really help the reader connect with the characters in the book. And in this case, these are real people, these are real events. You know, it's it really helps you know, make that connection and, you know, inspire people to read this and say, oh, well, you know, we hear about this one person, but maybe this other person, what did that other person do? Or when they hear that name sort of in another context, then they'll make the connection and sort of follow that up and that sort of thing. I sort of stepped up.
Yeah,
stepped
no, absolutely.
Your answer.
Absolutely.
Two more questions. One, if we talk about Congressman Lewis for a sec, if I remember hearing, I think I was talking to Chris a little, Chris Carlos a little bit last week at Baltimore. He was at San Diego, right? Congressman Lewis. He's been supportive of this book. Like when I heard it was sort of hardcore, like how he was like, okay, it's important for me to be there to do this. I mean, he's not just, you know, like I put my name on this and then you guys go off and do your little comic thing.
Right.
I mean,
he loves this.
Yeah, like what was his like San Diego schedule like? I mean,
it was the most intense schedule I've ever been a part of. Right. We were up at 8 a.m. It was our first appointment every day. We would do two or three interviews every day during breakfast. Then he would go the first day or early. We had to go to our panel. Then we had a signing, then more interviews, then another signing. And basically, we would go from 8 a.m. until about 6, 7 o'clock at night. Then we'd go get dinner, probably do an interview during dinner. Like, I think we had a reporter with us every night at dinner, too. And so it was really intense. We did that for 2 days with him. He did Saturday and Sunday.
Right.
And then took off Sunday evening on a red-eye back to Washington to then have votes on Monday.
Yeah.
Which is like, you know, you're talking about a guy who, like, doesn't have a lot of free time, and he was willing to give it so that he could go out there and work with these people and meet them and show them his new book. It was really special. And, you know, I think in some ways it also broke down the barrier that some... public officials have felt towards San Diego. Mm-hmm. You had Susan Davis, the congresswoman from the San Diego area, actually come out to greet the congressman.
Oh.
So we had both your first and then second member of Congress ever to go to San Diego. So it's all part of, I think, taking comics more seriously, putting them where they belong as forms of literature in the American canon, and seeing you know, fandom as we see it in a new way. You know, and hopefully it'll also engage in the reverse, where you know, people here, they vote with their dollars in some respects in the marketplace, but there's a voice in comics that should be heard and heard loudly, and maybe this will inspire someone to get in the way, as the congressman says.
Well, let's hope. My last question. March is going to be three parts. First part is out now, and the second and the third are coming in the next couple of years. Do you feel like you have another sort of comic in you, maybe? Is this, as sort of, I guess, comic experiences go, this is going to be probably hard to top, but do you feel like maybe...
Yeah, I don't think there's any way I could ever do a book that would be bigger than this, but...
You know, do you still have, like, another itch after this? You're like, I want to scratch something.
Yeah, there's a story I have in my head that my mother's dubbed the teacher story.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington meets Good Will Hunting in a weird way. you know, I mean, I've worked in professional politics now for about a decade. And there's a lot of things I think are wrong with it. And there's a lot of things I see that, you know, maybe on the outside people don't see. And I don't really want to throw anybody under the bus, but I have a lot of commentary on the political system. And I think, you know, there's a barrier from the average man, like, going and becoming an elected official, whether it's money, name recognition, things like that. And there's something wrong with that, you know. Corporations have way too much influence on our elections. Corporate money is out of control. And I'd like to tell a story where it sort of shows what the individual would go through. And what I believe, you know, as an operative for a number of years, they would have to do to overcome that. And then maybe somebody will.
Fiction, non-fiction, combination?
It'll have to be fiction, you know what I mean? Like, nobody can...
Oh, that's true.
You know, it's just a what if.
Thinly veiled.
I don't think it'll even be thinly, you know what I mean? Like, I've worked with some really great people over the years. So, I mean, they're not anybody who I would necessarily deal with specifically. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it's a system. And right. When you look at a system, there's certain things that happen because of the way the cogs work.
Right.
And, you know, I think that's something I would really like to delve into. Sort of Aaron Sorkin-esque, right? Like, he's gone on to do The Newsroom. Like, where were the guys who were writing The West Wing again? You know, I miss that. I used to watch that show all the time in college, you know? And I'd sort of like to get back to that and just, like, just write something that, you know, is fun. That's sort of personal and at the same time, like, ends up being sort of uplifting in the end. So I think we need that, you know? We need a little bit of happy endings, like some good stories, even if it's really tough to get there.
Yeah. A little hope every once in a while, you know, is a good thing. One addendum question. So obviously comics have been a big part of your life. What did you grow up reading? What sort of you know, started the fire sort of in you?
So my very first issue was Uncanny X-Men 317, Phalanx Covenant.
Oh.
Right? You remember the lenticular
cover?
Yeah. My grandmother bought it for me at a Piggly Wiggly in Western North Carolina.
Piggly, nice.
Yeah. But, you know, I used to read a lot of Green Lantern and a lot of Flash. Mike Wieringo is one of my early favorite artists.
Oh.
I have a Flash head sketch that he did for me when I was like 13. Mm-hmm. It's one of my favorite pieces I have, you know, and it means so much to me, and I miss the hell out of him. I really wish he was still with us. And, you know, like Flash, Green Lantern, but also a lot of the Marvel stuff. Like, I was an X-Men kid, totally. Mm-hmm. And then later in life, I really moved towards indie comics, you know. Mm-hmm. Once I got to college, once I met girls, it was like sort of a realization that there were stories that dealt with that too, you know, because in some ways, like when you're a kid and you're reading it, it's escapism. When you get older, you're looking for somebody to relate to. Mm-hmm. It's like, tell me it's going to be okay, right? Like,
a little bit.
Come on, get me through this, right? Like, I am awkward as hell, you know, like, tell me it's going to all be okay. And so I started reading a lot of indie stuff. Like, so one of my favorites was Box Office Poison, which when I actually...
Ironically enough.
Right? A top shelf book. And so it was crazy to me when I pitched... Because I pitched Chris Stardos on this project over the table at Mocha in 2010.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Hey, dude, I have an idea. You know? Now, I'd been referred to him and introduced him. We knew I was coming. But so I'm waiting there at the table patiently, and, like, who's in front of me but Alex Robinson? And so he's talking to me, and I'm like, oh, you know what? I'm going to get a copy signed by him, right? He does, like, a little head sketch and everything. He's like, what are you here for? I'm like, well, I'm actually going to tell Stardos, you know, I have this idea for a graphic novel. And he's like, what is it? And so I tell him, he's like, that's really cool. You should do that, man. Good luck. I really hope it works out for you. And I'm like,
God,
blowing my mind over here, you know? And so it's been really fun. A lot of these guys that I looked up to, like, I read their stuff when I was a kid. It definitely inspired me and helped me want to be in this industry and to do this way. To then be like sort of this holding the hand or like giving him my book then finally, like, you know, like it's just been really cool.
Oh man, that is I think that's a good note to go out on. Andrew, thank you so much for your time. Again, the book is awesome. It is a book we're going to talk about on the show, hopefully I think next week. It's our next book in the queue, so hopefully this interview will go sort of hand in hand with that. But thank you so much for your time, and I'm really looking forward to books 2 and 3 and what else you have coming up.
Great talking to you, man. Appreciate it.
I am here with Michelle Fife, the artist, writer, creative mastermind of Copra and Zegas. How's the show going for you?
It's great, Greg. Thanks so much for interviewing me and chatting me up.
Well, thank you so much for putting out such awesome work. Now, we've talked about Copra on the show a little bit, but why don't you just give like the elevator pitch of sort of what it is.
Elevator pitch is the Dirty Dozen, Suicide Squad, my version of those things in my way, which is probably the worst way to describe that.
I don't know. I mean, the Suicide Squad thing, now, it's not just the idea of the Suicide Squad. You're inspired by a very specific version of that, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the basic premise is just renegade misfits off on weird adventures, and it's drawn in my style, which isn't your typical mainstream style. But I am inspired by old mainstream comics, and so I try to include all those sort of aesthetic choices into these things. On top of other things, you know, like European sensibilities and alternative sensibilities. I just try to mix it all up because it's all the stuff I like, so...
Yeah,
it's not even that... I'm not even that aware of it. I just kind of make it, especially on this schedule that I have, which is a monthly comic.
Yeah, that's insane. Let me just say that right now. Because, I mean, you say monthly, and it is pretty... I mean, it's pretty much every... You know, 4 or 5 weeks or whatever.
4 to 5 weeks, sometimes 6, depending on the shipping or depending on whatever else happens, you know.
Now,
roughly a month.
Okay. Now, where can people find your work? How do they get copies of your
work? Well, they want to start out from the beginning. They could go to Bergen Street Comics.
Okay.
And they're the ones who are selling the compendiums, which collect the sold-out issues.
Okay.
One of them collects 1 through 3, the other is 4 to 6. So that's a good starting point. And then if they want to catch up, they could do the monthlies with me. They could just seek me out, go to my website. I have links to all that stuff. I try to make everything as available as possible.
Okay. And your comics are, what, 32 pages an issue?
No, they're
40. I mean, they're thick.
No, I'm not that insane, Greg.
Really?
No. They're 24. They're 24.
You use like a heavy paper stock.
The paper stock's going to last, but it's 24 pages plus covers and stuff. The compendiums collect all that stuff, so the compendiums are pretty thick.
Okay.
24 pages, full story, no fluff, no ads, no sometimes a pinup. Not a pinup, like a splash page, you know.
No.
I try to make as much out of the real estate that I have, you know.
You do have some like fan art in there. I remember seeing a drawing by one of the guys from Sidebar, I think.
Adrian Johnson.
Yeah.
Mr. Adrian Johnson. Great guy, great artist.
Yeah,
I love that show.
It was a really good... I didn't know he was quite that good of a.
I couldn't. Oh, he's a great artist. I couldn't quite fit it in the letters page, which is where I put the fan art.
Right.
But he made the Copra logo in the X-Men font. Uh-huh. And it just looks super cool. He's a great guy. So every time I get stuff like that, it blows me away. I'm really flattered and humbled, and it's so weird, in the best way weird, to see that my character is drawn by other people.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It feels like 32 pages worth of stuff because you put like so much work into this.
That's great.
Into this thing. The way I described it, I think on the show, if I'm remembering correctly, it's like a. A band now doing a cover version, or maybe like a sort of an alternative band now doing a cover version of a really poppy 80s song, like a reinterpretation of it. Because, I mean, you're very obviously drawing heavy influence from the Ostrander Suicide Squad stuff, and yet
right.
It feels like you're reinterpreting it in a way that seems sort of not effortless, but
more natural, maybe.
Yeah, like without like pretension. Like you're like, I'm gonna take this influence, and I'm going to be honest about it, but I'm gonna like do it sort of my way, in a way that like if a mainstream person were to try and do that now, they'd almost have like baggage that they would carry with it.
Uh-huh.
That like this is sort of how this should be done now, and you're like, no, I'm gonna take what I got then and just sort of filter it through me and just sort of give it back, as opposed to thinking like, oh, it needs to be this other thing in order to fit in this market. It feels very pure, if
right.
I can stumble around to a thing there. And yet it has such a through line from your inspiration, but it feels, it's just so pure, like it's so pure and such a wonderful... this experience to read it that is both reminding me of what superhero comics were like back then, and sort of what they maybe could be again if there weren't like so many other factors that were kind of in the way. I don't even know if there was an answer in that somewhere. But
there's
whatever.
A lot to chew on that. Yeah. But the thing is, I don't have, I guess, that so-called baggage mm-hmm. of like a mainstream artist that
right.
Grew up in that system.
Yeah.
You know, working in that system. I went off and did independent, alternative kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But always keeping my eye out on mainstream comics, mm-hmm. actually attempting a couple times to get in there.
Okay.
Still in my own style, never really trying to fit into a certain sort of mold or whatever.
Right.
So I think that may have helped.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, like I said earlier, I grew up with this sort of old mainstream comics. And maybe right. that style is even outdated in a way where it seems sort of like, that's not even mainstream, like almost... All the guys I like maybe a Klaus Janson can't get hired today if he were to start right now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like maybe that's a bad example because he's so great. Like you'll you know,
right,
he'll get hired anywhere.
He's clearly such an influence on you in your I guess your inking or like the work of like the brushwork and stuff. I look at this stuff and I feel very early 80s Miller. But
yes.
then on top of that, or even more of that. The Janson, because a lot of the times people look back at some of those old Daredevil stuff and they're like, oh, Miller's great. It's like, Miller, you
it
know,
really
is good.
Janson.
But it, yeah. like, he's doing breakdowns and it's Janson that's taken it the other, you know, half of the way or, you know, Janson's really pulling more of the weight than you would think.
It's a perfect collaboration, that comic. I mean, those guys are yeah. great. I mean, I even like Janson ripoff guys.
Like
I like his, I don't want to say ripoff,
okay.
But, like, there's a guy, I forget his name, Chris Honeymoon, or Mooneyham.
Yep.
Mooneyham.
Okay.
I think he does Five Ghosts.
Yes.
But the guy draws, like, fucking Janson Ink and Salbashima, which is great.
Yeah.
It's, like, my wheelhouse. I love that stuff.
Yeah, that's
or even guys like Greg Brooks, like, just random people. I think it was
right.
Janson's intern back in the day, or
okay.
background assistant. But anyway, not to get too inside baseball, but
no,
I just love that stuff.
Yeah,
I love those old comics. And I don't know. I mean, let me ask you this. Do you
okay.
think Copra... It's not... It's clearly not a nostalgia act, but it does
no.
kind of feel... It has a feeling of those old comics.
That's the thing. It's not...
Because some of those old comics are terrible. Like, they're written so badly. So
yeah.
I try not to replicate that too much. I'm trying to just kind of be inspired by the feeling I had from it.
Yeah, that's the
and
thing.
I don't know if that translates.
It does. It's not... That's the thing. It's not a nostalgia act. It's a... It's a distillation of what obviously made such an impact before
yeah.
that you're using you've taken it in, you've processed it, and you're using your obvious sort of skill to sort of work off of that springboard, but keeping with you what you picked up from all the mainstream comics and stuff that you
yeah.
learned before. It feels like a really good sort of gateway drug. For people that are like, hey, I like superheroes, but I don't like indie stuff.
Yeah.
I was like, this is the book I want to give them, where it's like, look, indie is okay. Like, it's indie, but it's not like, oh, man, you know, mainstream is crap, or, like, indie is crap. You're like, no, they can go together in a lot of different ways, and this is one of them,
yeah.
right? Like, this is, it's clearly mainstream inspired, but it's clearly in your layouts and in your approach to the work and everything. It's very... It's a wonderful sort of amalgam of all these different things that go along with it, and like I've said on the show and in sort of talking to other people, I was like I love this book because it hits a very specific target, I'm literally looking right at it on your table. I'm like, oh man, I love what it reminds me of. I love what it's doing. And again, it's not a nostalgia act,
yeah.
but it brings its history with it and uses that to tell a story that you don't... you certainly don't need... that's the other thing. You don't need to have read any, like, Suicide Squad before that. You know, not that there's any, like, official connection or anything. You know, nothing that would be legally actionable or anything. So let's... I don't want to give anyone that idea.
There's nods. I think if you're an old reader,
yes,
you'll
yes.
appreciate...
Right,
but
as a new reader, you can come in and read this and be like, "Man, this is just awesome. This is you know, mainstream, old mainstream comic influence, European influences. There's a lot going on in this. And what's the reception you've been getting from people? from this? Like,
good so far.
Okay.
Yeah, everyone seems to dig it. All sorts of people, all sorts of readers.
Okay.
Readers from my old stuff, new readers, people that read columns. You know, all the it's really word of mouth, because I have no marketing muscle to back this up beyond my own, you know, like Facebook, Twitter,
right.
Tumblr, emails,
right.
talking to friends, have them mention it, have reviews go up. Like, it's all just little by little, you know.
Okay.
And I think people may pick up on the fact that this isn't just a one-trick novelty. You know, it's
right.
something that I love doing, and,
right.
and I hope that comes across.
Yeah, it totally, totally does. Now, you're on issue 9 just came out this month.
Nine came out, yeah.
What are your plans moving forward with this book?
Well, I got to finish my commitment to 12 issues.
Okay. 12 and monthly issues.
12 monthly
way.
Issues. Okay. There was a lull and maybe in a couple of issues due to...
Close enough.
Yeah, yeah.
Close enough. Yeah, that's just insane for the amount of work you put into it. Anyway.
I'm going to take maybe a month or two to work on other things and finish off other projects and start writing the next batch of stories, the next year's worth. And I'm going to take it pretty much year by year.
Okay.
But I do have an ending. I do have like a mega arc for sure.
Okay.
And I'm going to work towards that.
Okay.
And try to explore as much as I can, as much as I humanly can on a monthly schedule. So we'll see how many compendiums we make. Hopefully there's a collected edition down the line. And we'll see what happens. Now, before you ask your next question,
uh-huh.
I want to touch upon something you mentioned about something like a mainstream artist.
Mm-hmm.
If they wanted to do this kind of thing,
yeah.
they would have their own, they would bring their own baggage to it.
Right.
Now, to you, what does that mean? Like,
maybe they would think that.
Because I think about this stuff all the time.
Okay.
So,
like, maybe
it's
like
super interesting
maybe that the indie route, like doing something that's so clearly what the mainstream has been built upon for at least the last 30 years or so,
right.
that they would have to go through mainstream channels in order to do something that was so sort of mainstream oriented, as opposed to saying, look, I can do what would sell in the mainstream, but I can do it in sort of the indie realm.
Right.
You know, like maybe they wouldn't make that connection. Whereas you were like, look, I want to do something. It clearly would work in the mainstream with a little, you know, a little extra, maybe a little bit of a different spin to, again, avoid some sort of comparisons.
Right.
Or
DC proper.
Yeah. You know, to calm the lawyers. But you're like, look, the indie... do-it-yourself DIY aspect can work for stuff that's other than like auto-bio comics or, you know, like I think somebody with your influences may not be comfortable or know enough about the indie realm to see that as a viable avenue for something that they have within them that is still sort of mainstream friendly.
Okay.
You know, whereas one of the things I really like about this book is, you know, we have we've read a lot of the same comics. We're coming from sort of the same place, but you were able to sort of pick the road less taken to be able to work those influences out and do your own thing. And I think as a crossover book, this is something that I would give to I would give to superhero friends and you know, to sort of get them involved in sort of indie stuff.
Well, another thing is that a lot of mainstream dudes, not all of them, of course, but they just may reach a level where they're sick of superheroes.
Right.
Excuse me. So when they get the chance to do their own stuff, they just don't do superheroes.
Right.
Which could work against them or could work for them.
Yeah.
It depends on the creator and what they eventually end up doing.
Yeah, it's all, you know.
I think that the success of the early Image run... the people, the creators, I think is due in large part to many things, but especially the fact that they just did exactly what they did at Marvel and on the books that made them popular.
Right.
So it's not like they completely changed the way, say, Frank Miller was popular for doing crime noir and superheroes with Daredevil, and then he just ups and does like a Mobius.
Like a Ronin. Like, what the hell is that?
Like a Lone Wolf and Cub riff.
Yeah.
Through like a European filter, you know, a weird comic compared to what came before and after, but you know, it wasn't a hit. for all intents and purposes. It's right. all so it was kind of like a weirdo book, and a lot of people thought that was like as weird as it gets, you know. And it I think it polarized his fan base. Not enough, you know. It's who remembers Ronin at this point, but in the face of Daredevil and Sin City and Batman. Right.
Now it's interesting because we've talked about this on the show, and like you said, early Image starts off and they do basically exactly the same sort of thing that they did at Marvel. But that success allowed them to build enough of a financial base or whatever to then have people like Sam Keith come into Image. Where you're like your Image second wave, where it's like, look, we've got money, we'll help publish your book. You can do whatever the hell it is that you want to do. And Sam Keith, who we talked about, I think a little bit ago on the show, he comes in and does the Max, and it's interesting to see like the early Max is almost like him kind of doing. Like, okay, Spawn fans are going to be reading this book. It should be more like Spawn. But even, like, issues 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, he drifts away from that and sort of does really his own thing. And, you know, the money off of superheroes then allows him to go and explore all these other areas. And right. so Image is a really interesting experiment in that thing of, you know, money being able to help. Creators maybe not necessarily being known for doing like an experimental work, but being fans of it and using mainstream money to then fund other stuff. Do you need to?
Right. I think it's funny that you mentioned Sam Keith because he's another example of someone who may not really get hired by a mainstream company these days.
Yeah,
maybe. I mean, Marvel, I think, takes more risk in terms of talent. Yeah. But Sim Keith is just too off-kilter, man.
Yeah.
Just too weird.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, we see it as like, oh, just cool, or we could clearly see his influences. I don't know. And I know he's done stuff for DC recently, but that's just because he's an established creator.
Right. If you were trying to get hired today.
But if he was submitting pages like that looked like that, forget it. They would say, work on your anatomy, kid. Fuck out of my office. Or wherever they conduct those sort of meetings. I guess cons now.
You'd be like, you need to look like this. And they pass over Jim Lee comic, you're like, oh god.
I mean, there's always exceptions. Yeah, and that doesn't mean there's no talent there.
Right.
In those camps.
No.
But it's just kind of interesting to see what came before.
The days of an editor at the big two being able to not only either recognize or be able to use somebody that they see is talented, whether it fits what the house style is or not, I think are either going or gone.
Well, I mean, that's always been a job. I feel like editors, it's mostly just been a job.
Yeah.
And some treat it like something else, and that comes through. You know, some actually hire people that they respect and admire. Others just need to get it done, or a combination of both, or maybe none of them. Maybe they just want to put some fucking books out, and that's it. And there's nothing wrong with that.
It's
us that attach the sort of reverence to the material, and some of it deserves it, some of it doesn't. All I know is that books need to be made, and they're going to be made regardless of the talent. You know, it's just a business. So I think also when it comes to something like Hopper, and within those parameters, it doesn't need to exist. It only needs to exist for me.
Right.
You know? So that's why the approach is different. The results are different. Mm-hmm. But you could still see the similarities because I like that other stuff.
Right.
You know?
Right. But you...
I don't just like it. It's part of the language that I use to make these things happen.
Yeah, it's like part of your DNA. It came in at a certain point and it attached itself to you. And then you just carry it with you. The rest of your life, and then you decide in this project, am I going to let more of that out, or you know, maybe like with Zegas, the book you were, or the stories you were working on sort of before Copra, you know, it didn't come out as much, you know, or that particular sort of thing, I'm assuming, didn't sort of come through almost at all.
Right. I mean, well, not for their stories.
Not right.
You know, and especially the main difference too is also that was my. The comic I did at night after my day job. You know, Copra is pretty much everything I do. And I think that affects the work and the way I approach it. You know, and that's all, it's part of it. I knew what I was getting into somewhat, you know.
Let's talk about process for a second. So it takes you 4 or 5 weeks-ish to put an issue together?
Just about, yeah. Just about.
Do you write, like, do you sit down and write a script and then sort of approach it as an artist, or is it sort of like, do you put anything down on paper before you start?
I plot it out and then I dialogue everything or whatever caption I need.
Okay.
And then I go straight to drawing. I don't type anything out. Okay.
What's the part of it that's most fun for you? Because I've heard some people say, like, the layouts are, like, the fun part, and everything else is just sort of mechanically sort of working off that. What part of the chain is...
I see how layouts could be fun. Mm-hmm. But to me, at this point, it's a little redundant, because I end up reworking whatever layouts I make when I'm drawing it. So part of the way this process works is eliminating certain steps. I don't type out a script for someone to draw, because I'm doing it for myself. I could read my own handwriting. I don't need to go through an editor. That has to go through an editor-in-chief and so on and so forth. I don't have to wait for an inker. I could just ink it on the boards as quickly as possible, even though I have just a few basic shapes as pencils. Uh-huh. My pencils are a mess, man.
Right.
They're a fucking disaster. And that's fine, because I know what's going
to... Nobody needs to look at it other than you.
Exactly. And I usually have to make 2 to 3 pages a day, so I can't sit and refine it. I just have to do it. And I refine it when I ink it, or when I color it, or when I'm editing it at the end, when I give it a final pass. But that's pretty much how I do it.
Okay.
That's pretty much what I'm doing right now. Step by step, as quickly as possible. That's the main process, you know. There's no trick to it either. It's just building a confidence in living with your decisions. You know, because I used to go back and rework the shit out of my pages, do tons of rewrites, draw it over and over again, throw away pages, start over, and this time it's like I'm not allowing myself to do that. The schedule doesn't allow me to do that.
Did you do that for even the early issues of Copra, or was that all like once you started Copra, you're like, no, I gotta...
No, it's all pre-Copra. It's everything I've done before Copra.
Okay.
Even Death Zone, the Suicide Squad one, that was sort of planned, you know? I was a lot more careful with that.
Okay.
Not too careful, but, you know, I had enough time to kind of, like, work on it, so...
But just to recap, people can find your work at where?
You can just go to my site, michelfife.com. That's Michel, pretty much Michael without an A.
Okay.
Fife, F-I-F-F-E.
Okay.
.com. And everything's there, links to my Etsy store and other avenues where I have my comics.
And if somebody wanted to, so they basically go to your Etsy store and then they can buy, you know, like the individual issues.
They could buy the issues
the ones that are available.
Yeah, the compendiums.
If they wanted to subscribe, if they wanted to get, like, sort of on your mailing list or whatever, how do they do that?
Just buy anything. Buy a comic.
Hey,
yeah.
Okay.
Subscriptions, I'm going to start them up again with the new volume, with issue 13. I'm going to start doing that again. But I do have subscribers. I do try to sell to as many stores as will have Copra.
Okay.
You know? But mostly it's all through my site or through my Etsy site. For the compendiums, though, which reprint the sold-out issues, that's through BergenStreetComics.com.
Okay.
So they have a big cartel site, and it's all linked on my main page.
Okay.
It's all available, so...
And the compendiums will stay in print. So, like, the individual issues, you do, like, 500, 600, 700 copies.
They're
right?
800.
You're up to 800
now? Up to 800, yeah.
Okay.
Which is why I stopped numbering them, because... It's just too much.
Yeah.
You know?
But the compendiums will stay in print,
as long as possible, as long as people buy them.
Okay.
You know?
Well, I've seen your stack shrink as I walk by this entire weekend, so it's great to see. People are buying it, people are looking at it, people are digging it. I know I'm enjoying the hell out of it. And
well, thanks for the shout-out.
Oh, no.
Back then, I remember that show.
It's...
it's things like that help. Word of mouth.
It's the least I can do. You're the one doing the work. The least I can do is tell people, hey, you need to check this shit out because it is awesome. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today. And, let's have you on the show soon because there's whole tracks of stuff I really want to ask, but I've been standing for way too long. I need to go sit down.
Go take a break.
I still
got to finish out the day. So.
Yeah. Well, I've taken enough of your time. Again, thank you so much for talking to us, and hope you have a good rest of the show.
No problem. Thank you.
Hi, this is Greg. I am still here at SPX 2013, and I'm having the good fortune of talking to Joe Infernari. Joe, how's the show been going for you?
It's actually been really good. It's been a great show, I would have to say, so far. I mean, we are kind of like a couple hours from the end, but I feel very good about it. It's been great.
Is this your first this isn't your first SPX, is it?
No. Last year I was here, I shared a table with Dean Haspiel, but this year I'm with Ryan Alexander Tanner. So it's been 2 years in a row that I've actually tabled. I've been to SPX a few times, but only as an attendee.
Okay. Where are you? You're based out of what, New York?
I'm originally from Canada. I have to give props to the Great White North.
That's right, that's right, that's right.
And, but yes, I'm currently living in Brooklyn, New York. Right. Okay.
Now, you have a couple of different things, or you've got at least one thing premiering this at this show. What do you have premiering?
There's two. You were
right.
Okay. I have the second installment in the Time Fucker story.
Okay.
And Oh My Dear Mom. If she ever hears this, the poor lady. Such a sweetheart to hear her son, the filth that comes from his mouth. So we have Time Fucker 2 and then Versus, a story I did with a really excellent writer working out of New York City by the name of Alexis Attile.
Okay. For the people that aren't here at SBX, how can they get these books?
I haven't been very good about making, like, Time Fucker 1 is available on my website, joinfernari.com, and that, you can read the entire first chapter. Now, the second chapter, the one that's premiering this weekend, is probably not going to be made available in its entirety on the web, but what I will do is, since I'm now so versed in putting together CBRs and PDFs and various other files for the
web,
we'll get
to that in a second.
I'll be making it available for download as well as, you know, online ordering.
Okay.
Very soon after the show.
Okay. Can you give us a quick, before we'll talk about the bunker in a sec, but before we leave Time Fuckers, can you give us a sort of an elevator pitch?
Yeah, I'm terrible at these, but it's, I keep referring to the back of the first book, which basically describes poor Sal Gisboro, a man who's lived his life in fear and running away, and he's blamed his younger half-brother Dick for all of his woes.
Mm-hmm.
And so when he comes across Thomas Edison's peep show time machine, he sees his opportunity to go back in time, have sex with his promiscuous mother, and basically impregnate his mom before Dick is born and eliminate Dick from the equation.
Okay.
So by the end, so what I like to say is, by the end of the first book, Sal Gisboro is dickless.
Okay.
Are you all right?
Yeah,
are
I'm good. Okay? I'm good. Hey, I bought it. I bought both of them yesterday.
Okay, I worry. I worry.
No. I'm good. I haven't had a chance to read them, but they're gorgeous.
Oh, thank you.
And I've already bought them. So.
How strong is your stomach?
Pretty strong.
Good.
Pretty strong.
You see how I'm trying to reverse the tables on you and make it so I'm asking you questions?
I see that.
But you're...
I'm good with it.
Okay.
I'm good with it.
Yeah. And
you do a little judo.
You've been doing this enough that whatever I bring to the table, you can handle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you're a Canadian, so I feel like I'm okay. I can handle that. You know?
Yeah, that's what I'd like you to think.
Lull me into a full sense of security. let's judo this conversation over to the bunker.
Well, the bunker is Josh Fialkov's brainchild. It's an amazing story about five recent college grads who are about to embark on the rest of their lives, probably separate from each other, and as a last kind of like hurrah, they decide to bury a time capsule in the, I think it's near Los Angeles woods. Josh would know better.
Yeah.
And so they're just about to do that, and they break ground and hear if they don't hit against some sort of like metal structure under the earth.
Mm-hmm.
And with a little investigation, and seeing that their names are actually printed, all but one name is printed on the outside of the bunker, they go inside.
Mm-hmm.
And inside they find records, newspapers, boxes full of electronic components and things of all various kinds of detritus. And also they find four letters.
Okay.
And it's four letters from their future selves encouraging them to make the apocalypse happen. And that's because the apocalypse is the best case scenario.
Okay, that's...
And so the story has them having to grapple with the veracity of these letters, as well as the kind of ominous message that they seem to carry.
Where can people find the bunker?
Well, the bunker is available DRM-free on our site, which is www.thebunkercomic.com or whatisthebunker.com. Okay. And we have both chapters available in either PDF or CBR formats.
Okay.
But the both chapters are also available at Comixology. Mm-hmm. And it's also available with a subscription service. So as they come out every month, which is our plan, you can be subscribed to it at Comixology and receive them automatically, I believe.
Was getting it into Comixology something that was important? I'm assuming it was important to both you and to Josh. I mean, that's sort of becoming kind of, you know, the main marketplace or the main newsstand or whatever of the of the 21st century. Was that a easy process or?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, they did everything they could to make it easy for us. And in fact, I believe Josh talked about the bunker a little while back before we actually had, like, this was, like, I guess early on in its genesis. He talked about it on Bleeding Cool.
Mm-hmm.
And Chip Mosher over at Comixology sent me an email, fired me off an email saying, hey, if you guys do this and you want to do it digital, we'll put it on Comixology and we'll promote the hell out of it. And so they were on, they were on board before it was even a thing, before they'd even seen it.
Nice.
So, yes, they were definitely part of the plan, and they've done nothing but wonders and wonders for us.
Okay.
Chip has done a great job on our behalf.
Good. That's good to hear. So you said that there's a subscription service.
Yeah, to be completely honest with you, I've never done the subscription service with Comixology.
Neither have I.
Right, so I'm not a good person to really talk about how that exactly works, but the bunker is going to be coming out every month, and so as it does so, I think as a subscriber, you get kind of like it maybe automatically, or you maybe purchase like a block of them at a time, and then when they become available, you get them.
Okay.
That's something I would encourage readers or people listeners. Yeah. What podcast?
Well, readers, maybe they can read the information about the episode and then listen to it. So they are both readers and listeners.
And
something for them to look into.
Right. So I would encourage people to, because I think what happens for a lot of people is once they get the first chapter under their belt, they're hooked.
Yeah.
And so I think a subscription makes sense. Mm. I would also encourage anybody out there to sign up for our newsletter at the thebunkercomic.com.
Okay.
And if you do that, you'll also get early access to every chapter. So chapters will, if they come out on a Monday or a Wednesday, you'll get them on either like the Saturday or the Monday, respectively.
Okay.
I hope I haven't made that too confusing.
If you get hooked on the series, and you will once you read it, if you want to get it earlier than everybody else, go to the Bunker website and sign up there.
Yeah. That was good.
That was my takeaway. Glad to see I got that. And I completely forgot what my next question was going to be now that I threw that in. Is there an endpoint in mind?
Well, I have looked at a very, very secret document.
Okay.
In that document, it outlines the kind of like the larger narrative strokes for the next 3 years.
Okay.
So that is already kind of like percolating in Josh's genius brain.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure he'll be able to come up with just as intriguing and head-scratching and amazing ideas for anything beyond that time.
Okay.
Personally, it's a thrill for me because every month I get Josh's script.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very as much a fan and a reader of the material as anybody else
out
there.
Right, as we are. Yeah.
And so I don't have the entire big picture because it does evolve as we go along.
Okay.
And so I would say we're as much along for the ride as the readers are, but I know Josh does have a master plan.
Okay. That does not surprise me at all.
Yeah.
how much of your day does the bunker take up? Are you working on something else? Is it just all bunker all the time right now?
No. I'm working on a graphic novel for Dark Horse Comics with Cecil Castellucci. About
I just bought a book from Nate Powell that
right, Year of the Beast.
Yes.
So
certain names are just in the air.
So anyway. I'm working with her on a graphic novel that'll likely be coming out. We're aiming for like Thanksgiving of 2014.
Okay.
And we don't have a title final yet.
Okay.
But I am working on that.
Is that a like a full graphic novel,
yes,
or is it a because the Year of the Is it You're the Beast?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not a...
Was a combination of, like, prose and then sequentials and then...
Right. No, it'll be, like, full
comics.
Full on. Right. Yeah.
Okay. Good. Is there anything else that's sort of coming up, aside from the Dark Horse thing that you want to mention? I mean, obviously, people will be able to see your work on a monthly basis for the bunker.
Right. I think right now I have had kind of like a nice kind of creative flurry with getting verses in print and writing and drawing Time Fucker 2. And so now I think my focus is going to shift back more to the Dark Horse comic and the Bunkers, of course. And I think also to start to kind of write and put together the next creative flurry, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. And just process questions, sort of really, really quickly. So putting together the bunker now, it's presented landscape format and a format sort of friendly for tablets. And I'm assuming that's probably going to be one of the main things people are going to be reading it on. Are there any artistic differences that you bring to bear in working on a web strip like the bunker versus something in print like Time Fucker, even if they're both landscape formatted comics?
Right. Well, certainly the landscape format, when you know the project is going to be on the web, let's say, or on screen, that's a good place to kind of start. So that's one way that that decision gets made. But I've been doing that, the thing is, I've been doing that enough now that I'm very comfortable with it, and I do very much enjoy it, and I think when it comes into print, and the files and everything that I've been working with on the bunker are ready for print. When it is printed, I like the widescreen kind of like, it's sad, I don't know, I don't like to make that kind of analogy to film, but the very wide kind of strip of comics is...
So for the people that can't see this at home,
you imagine the book open.
Right, so you're going to have essentially what are going to be like two screens laying side by side with each other. Do you take that into account as you're drawing... Like that first, what's going to be the first screen, even though they're not going to be able to see like the second screen, sort of right next to it at the same time.
Right.
Do you think ahead? It's like, hey,
yes. The pagination,
composition wise and stuff. Are you thinking like these will go together well?
Definitely. Okay. Like the way it's created has that already built into it. So I kind of have the pagination already worked out. So the spreads when it comes to print are already in place. We know what those are going to be. And in fact, actually, when readers catch up with episode 3 at the beginning of October, you're going to you can probably imagine that even better. There are pages in there that are like there's an action sequence in there that does very much use the page spreads, even though you won't see them as in their digital format.
Good.
Does that answer?
That totally does. This is kind of it's kind of a new area we're going into with digital and then print and creating things that are in some ways for some people they're like purely digital and they don't want to worry about print, and other people are like purely print, they don't want to worry about digital, and the people that are sort of like, well, I want to take advantage of digital but also being a fan of print, and everyone kind of has to find their own way through this, through the wilderness that we're all sort of in.
Right, but I also want to make a point too, and I think we talked about this earlier, and that is, a studio mate of mine, Mike Cavallaro, a while back made an insight that has really stuck with me, and that is that even though this is going back to the landscape format, it seems sort of like a product of the digital comics age, but in fact it really does harken back a lot to the early newspaper comics.
Right, like the Sunday comics and stuff, where you would have like you know, a three-panel strip or like a six-panel strip where you have sort of your two tiers.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, yeah, you. That's right. You pointed that out to me yesterday, and they did look very much like, you know, the landscape comics that we're, you know,
right,
we're thinking of now. Something not quite, something a little taller than like the three-panel strips.
Right.
But stuff like the old Flash Gordon Adventure stuff was the two-tier three-panel.
Yeah, I think it's probably, if not the same, a very close, like, ratio of, like, height to width as those old comics.
That's it's a little mind-blowing.
Yeah, I can see. It is, well, right?
Like, wow.
When he's I overheard him say that in conversation, and I was like, yeah, that is what it is.
It's like everything old is new again. Wow. Yeah. Mind blown. Okay, so I think this is a good place to sort of bring this to a close. I need to roll this around a little bit. Again, where can people find your work?
Well, it's available on my website at joeinfernari.com.
Okay, how do you spell that?
That's J-O-E,
okay.
I-N, F as in Frank, U-R, N as in Nancy, A-R-I.com.
Okay.
And then, of course, also at the thebunkercomic.com and whatisthebunker.com.
But I mean, you have links for that on your. If they go to joeinfernari.com, that's
yes.
They can find everything else through that.
Definitely.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to us.
Anytime, Greg. Okay. Anytime.
I'm here sitting, thank God, with the publisher, proprietor, criminal mastermind behind. Picture this press. I say criminal mastermind because every time I look at one of your books, you literally steal money out of my wallet. I'm, of course, talking to Joe Procopio here at SPX 2013. Joe, how's the show been going for you?
It's fantastic. This is my favorite show to attend and to exhibit at. And just gathering of the tribe for all of these just wonderful creative talents who just pour so much passion into this medium.
Why don't you give people an idea of Lost Art Books? Why don't you tell people what that's about?
So basically, Lost Art Books is the imprint I created. The impetus behind it was there's all this wonderful material and these great artists from early 20th century that have fallen into obscurity, and their work is just unknown and underappreciated. And I wanted to revive it and put it back out there for modern audience, because I think that people would really enjoy it if they had a chance to see it again.
You cover not only illustrators in sort of an illustrative sense, or like old, you know, magazine illustrators, but you also do comics with your latest work, which is debuting here at the Expo. Why don't you tell us what the new book in the line is?
Yeah, it's The Lost Art of Matt Baker. And it collects this collection. It's our first volume in a three-volume series on his work. And this first volume collects his entire Canteen Kate material. And Canteen Kate was a character that was published during the Korean War from 51 to 53. And she had three issues of her own comic, and then probably another dozen or so stories scattered around in other war comics and things like that. So this collects all 22 of the Canteen Kate stories. Matt Baker illustrated them all, and it's just a perfect example of his good girl art and, you know, just a slice of what, you know, a humor comic in that period would have been like. The interesting thing about Matt, one of the interesting things about Matt Baker, not only was he just an incredible artist, but he is known for a couple of firsts, one of them being that he was the first, or one of the very first, African-American artists to break into the comics industry. He started in the early 1940s and had a career that went into the late 1950s when he died at age 37 from a congenital heart failure. But he's also known for drawing what is arguably the first graphic novel. It Rhymes with Lust is the name of the graphic novel. And I'm not exactly sure. I think it came out in around 51, 52, something like that. But it was one of the first, maybe the first sort of long-form story And I think Dark Horse put a reprint of that out a few years ago.
One of the things I think is just really interesting is that these are obviously artists whose work has sort of fallen into obscurity. So what are some of the challenges, or what's like the main challenge in sort of bringing out a book that about an artist that you want to showcase? I mean, these are, it's like the Matt Baker, the comics, those are your, those came from your personal collection, right?
Yes, that's right. And that's, you know, one of the challenges is just being able to lay your hands on the material, acquire the material, and it can take years to gather the material that eventually ends up in one of my books. And so the Matt Baker book in particular, it required tracking down, I forget how many now, but it was, about 15 comics, I think, to be able to do a comprehensive, complete package of all the Canteen Kate material. And these are Gold Age comics, and there are a lot of people who collect this material and love this material, so it's not always easy to find it, and when you do find it, it's not always easy to be able to acquire it in your within your budget. So it took me 4 or 5 years to finally gather up all the issues, and I got all of them except one, and the one I couldn't track down, I was lucky enough to have another collector who's a good friend who had it in his collection. He provided it for me so I could make a scan of that.
Okay.
But, with all the other books, it's material that, it's a century old, some of it, and has not been reprinted since its original publication. Very difficult to find. I'm just an obsessive bibliophile and collector of this stuff, and I've acquired and amassed a lot of it, and so that drives somewhat what projects I choose to pursue. It's whether or not I have enough material in my collection, or I think I can have a shot at sort of locating that material, enough of it to be able to actually put out a book that's worthy of the artist's legacy, because that's really what my stuff is about, is about trying to preserve the legacy of these works.
Well, thank God for your obsessive bibliophilic nature, because, you know, you're really able to bring to light a lot of stuff that, you know, people just wouldn't, I mean, certainly, I know I wouldn't have known about Heinrich Kley or Richardson or any of these guys without your work. But hopefully something that's easier to find is your website. Where can people find your books and information about your books?
Indeed. It's lostartbooks.com. And I have, biographical material on the artists up there. I have sample art from the books. I have a few videos that, spotlight some of the artists, spotlight the Lost Art Books imprint. And, go there, peruse what we have. It'll give you a flavor for what the books are about and what these artists' work is like. And I think that, we've put out about a half a dozen books now, and I think that there's something, we have a broad enough sort of sampling of material now that I think everybody will find something there that intrigues them.
I agree. Joe, thank you so much for your time, and look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. Thanks.
Hopefully this is going to work. All right. Hi, this is Greg. I'm still here at SPX 2013, and I'm having the good fortune of talking with Mr. Nate Powell. Nate, how's the show been going for you?
Oh, it's been awesome. This is my 10th year to come. It's my favorite show in the country, so it's always a joy. Great sense of community here. The sales are always good. No complaints.
Wow, is that 10 consecutive years?
Yeah, I started in 2004.
Wow, that's quite the streak. But this year, I guess it's maybe a 10th anniversary. You've got kind of a special project you brought to the show. Why don't you tell people a little bit about the book you have debuting today?
Sure. The next few years of my life is working as the artist on a trilogy called March, mm-hmm. which is the graphic novel autobiography of civil rights icon and Congressman John Lewis. Mm-hmm. So book one has only been out for about a month. It's doing great. We brought in, John Lewis yesterday, did a panel, had an amazing turnout for a couple of signings we did. And in general, the response has been, you know, on a critical level, but on an emotional and personal level, it's just, you know, far surpassed my expectations. It's been wonderful.
I had a chance to read it. Got a copy signed by all three of you yesterday, and I had a chance to finally read it last night, and it was amazing. The three of you guys did a really, really wonderful job on it. It was, it was just really, really good. I had a chance to talk to Andrew Iden a little bit ago today. He, when you were brought onto the project, how was this sort of presented to you? What did you, can you describe that sort of process, like how you, where you sort of came in and
sure. Stuff? Basically, after I tried out for the spot and we agreed, you know, that I would join the team, John Lewis and Andrew had the script more or less finished at the time, but it was really only for a single 160-page graphic novel. So that's where I sort of got kind of gung-ho and took the narrative lead and started repacing the entire book to work in a narrative sense that was more natural for my storytelling style. And very quickly I realized we were dealing with about a 500-page epic. So in time, we decided to go ahead and chop it up as a trilogy, which made a lot of sense. And it became a very organic process. You know, I'm in touch with Andrew and the congressman several times a week in terms of, like, whether it's questions, details, memories, or, you know, like, larger structural or conceptual or, you know, like, you know, ethical or political issues surrounding the book. We've sort of been building it up at every level together, and it's been really nice.
Did you, now, is it a little weird having part of it out now, but you're still, like, for us, we look at it and it's like, oh, there's, like, a book, and you're like, I'm still working on it.
Yeah, I feel like it pulls in both directions. On one level, it's really motivating to see the first volume out and know that you can reach a finish line.
Right.
And to have these sort of incremental, you know, stages where, you know, you realize you can play the long game. Mm-hmm. At the same time, yes, the tone radically changes between books one and book two, you know, as resistance to the civil rights movement intensifies. It gets really dark and brutal. And so, and it also takes its emotional toll in terms of, like, being at the drawing board and working through those elements of the tale together. It's a daunting project. Yeah, knowing that I spent the last year and a half of my life working on this, but that I have three more years to go, you know, it's, it just takes a lot of discipline and being able to, like, yeah, see far enough into the future to recognize that not only will there be an end to the process, but that along the way, you know, there are these signposts of progress that will allow you to sort of get through the project unscathed.
Okay. Do you have anything else that you're working on at the same time as this to maybe... this isn't the only thing you're working on, like, right now.
Yeah, I'm also drawing a graphic novel adaptation of Rick Riordan's The Lost Hero, which is a Percy Jackson spinoff.
Okay.
That'll be out about a year from now. I'm also finishing up some short comic stories for inclusion in a book called You Don't Say, which Top Shelf will be putting out, I hope, in a year or so.
Okay.
That collects all of my out-of-print or otherwise unpublished short comics from Please Release to today.
Okay.
And once the trilogy is done, I'll be releasing my own next graphic novel that I wrote and drew, which will be called Cover.
Okay.
But that's several years down the line.
Okay. Do you think you would have been able to work on March, like, just all of it, like, all at once, or do you feel like that would have been an impossible task without having something else to sort of maybe alleviate, like, working on such a serious book? And I could have
done it. That was the plan, in fact. You know, I was anticipating to just do this single 500-page book before we made the decision to break it up. But the ways in which we've evolved as storytellers as a result of working through book one together and letting it stand alone has been so essential that I'm just so glad that it happened that way. It's a much better book for being broken up as a trilogy.
Okay. Did you have a... this may be like trying to ask you to pick a favorite of your children, but I mean, did you have a particularly favorite spot of book one that you were just like, I really nailed that part, or I was really happy with
Definitely.
That in particular?
My two favorite scenes were, there's a scene with him as a child talking about his beloved chickens, and they're really intense personal scenes about, him not just preaching to his chickens, but baptizing his chickens and this sort of very intense relationship he has to them. But also the scene in which the congressman and his peers are getting arrested and beaten and harassed for the first time at the Woolworths during their early sit-ins. But his description of his feelings of liberation and transcendence in finally having been arrested and crossed over a threshold in, in his activism, but in his life and in his spiritual growth, that had a profound effect on me. And it's also some of my favorite comics pages I've ever drawn.
There've been times that I thought I could last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come.